Brandenberger. So Professor Brandenberger received his diploma in physics from ETH Zurich in Switzerland, 1978. His MA in physics from Harvard, PhD in physics also from Harvard. And he did postdocs at the ITP in Santa Barbara and at the University of Cambridge in the UK. And he was assistant professor of physics at Brown University, and then moved to associate professor at Brown, and finally full professor of physics at Brown University, which is almost still present. And now he's, at present, he's professor of physics at McGill University, beginning this year. And Professor Brandenberger's research areas include theoretical cosmology, specifically inflationary universe cosmology, superstring cosmology, topological defects in the early universe. So let's make Professor Brandenberger feel welcome.
So what's the bad idea to clap before someone has done anything? Now, I would like to welcome you all to Canada. I know half of you are from Canadians, half of you are not from Canada. Especially those of you who are not from Canada, I'd like to invite. As you heard from the introduction, I'm fairly recent. I'm a recent arrival in Canada, as many people who live here. And I would like to urge those of you who are not from Canada to explore the great features of this country. So I would like to tell you something about my research, which is cosmology, modern cosmology. And what I'd like to emphasize is both how much we have learned recently, but more than that, how much we do not know. Because especially for those of you who want to go on to study physics, it's probably more important to realize how much there is that we do not understand than what we already understand. If you go on to a career in physics, you will be contributing to trying to resolve the problems we are facing now. So again, bear in mind that where I want you to be, where I want to trend up, is appreciating not so much what we've learned, but what we do not know. But I will start by at the very beginning. So what is cosmology? Cosmology is a very interesting science. Because it unifies two questions which appear to be quite different in style. So the first aspect of cosmology is quite quantitative. We would like to understand the observed classes structure of the universe. So we would like to gain an understanding of the observed structure of the universe. And observed structure of the universe, galaxies, what goes beyond galaxies. But there's more to the observed structure of the universe, which I'll get to. So now those of you who have taken physics in high school, as an analyst in physics in high school, you know that physics is basically an experimental science where you observe things in the laboratory and then you try to understand what's going on. Now I believe that physics, or a large part of physics, is moving the laboratory to the telescope. But the function of operating is very similar. We measure things by telescopic observations, it's observed structure of the universe, and then we try to see whether we can understand where this comes from. So this is physics, experimental science, empirical science, like any other science. But then cosmology has a very different aspect to it. Mainly we would like to understand the history and the future of the universe. So, where does the observed structure of the universe come from? What was the history of the universe? What could its future be? Now, this question might appear to be more philosophical, but what is nice about modern cosmology is that in the context of modern cosmology, these two questions are treated in a unified fashion. We can understand the observed structure by having understood history. So now to emphasize what I mean by this question, I'd like to ask you a question. History of the universe, well, the universe is expanded. Who disagrees with that? No one disagrees with that. The universe has expanded forever. Who disagrees with that? There was a big bang at the beginning. Who disagrees with that? What that's a problem? What's the beginning? What? Obviously, when I say was there a big bang at the beginning, implicit in that is already the statement that there was a beginning. So who disagrees with the statement that there was a big bang? Now, I just think that those of you who raised your hands to the previous question should also raise a hand now. So let's see. Yes, now. I would ask again who believes that there was a big bang. Now, since all of you believe that there was a big bang, what was before the Big Bang? Does anyone know what there was before the Big Bang? Who raises their hand now? So let's get this agreement now. So you see, these questions appear to be philosophical questions, but we can actually make some headway to try to get at them. So to repeat what I said, I have this overhead, like Zandavari said. So I'll be doing a mixture between presenting things on the blackboard and showing you guys salad. So what I want to do is I want to start out with describing what we know about the observed structure of us. What I want to emphasize here is how much we have learned recently, how fast the field is progressing compared to my life as it was described. So you may consider that things that I consider very rapid took an incredible length of time. So now if we look out at the sky, what's the first thing that we see? Stars. But the stars are much too small to really be the focus of our cosmology. So if we look beyond the stars, then we see concentrations of stars. So the building blocks of what cosmologists consider the observed structure are the galaxies. So this is a picture of a star galaxy. Now galaxies, what I want to impress you with now is a huge size of a galaxy. So a galaxy such as the one whose picture I'm showing you comprised about 10 billion stars. And it's a huge dimension, length dimension that we're talking about. We can't really measure this in, it doesn't make sense to describe the dimension of a galaxy in terms of kilometers, miles. So what's a better measure to use? Is light travels incredibly fast, so therefore a small number of light years corresponds to huge distance. Well, a galaxy like this, a nice spiral galaxy, is about 100,000 light years long and wide, and about 3,000 light years thick. And it may look like a compact object here if you look at it from so far away, as we are looking at this galaxy. But the individual stars in this galaxy are quite far apart, they think 1 mile apart. So light year is a good measure because that's the distance between stars in a galaxy. And millions of light years is a good distance scale that I'll be interested in, because galaxies are, if you look at different galaxies, they are a distance of about 1 million light years. So now, in cosmology, modern cosmology, we are not interested in galaxies. Galaxies are too small. We will replace a whole galaxy by a point. So then we get to the lasting structure of the universe. And I have a picture, the best picture available. This was taken, this picture was taken by the Hubble Space Telescope. Now, this is a very high precision view of a very small region of the sky. Almost each point is a galaxy, except for a couple of these bright objects, which are stars. So there are huge numbers of galaxies in the universe. And in this picture, they might appear to be more or less randomly distributed. But this is because we just look at the image, a two-dimensional image of a three-dimensional distribution of galaxies. So we would like to, when we are studying the observed structure of the universe, then we study the distribution of galaxies in three-dimensional space. So, and to illustrate what we are doing, I will do something on this board over there, because that is not really important. What astronomers do is they have access to half of the celestial sphere. You know, from a particular point on the surface of the Earth, they have access to half of the celestial sphere. Celestial spheres rotate around you from our perspective. So a particular telescope will be able to measure out a particular slice of the sky. What we do is to focus in with the telescope on all galaxies you can see, and you try to measure the distance of each galaxy from us. Now who knows how you measure the distance of a galaxy from us? That's small. For galaxies, it no longer works. They are too far away.
Stars like the expected
and the negative star? Too sophisticated. It's easier than that. If you listen to a car whizzing by you, so that's how we measure the distance of star of galaxies. So next picture is the biggest, the largest image of the observed structure that we have in about 1990. So this was the most detailed map of the observed structure. We are here. This is the distance from us. This direction is, and I'm highlighting the red box for this direction in the sky. Each point is a galaxy. And I think now all of you, no one will disagree with my claim that galaxies are not randomly distributed. There's a very special pattern to the distribution of galaxies. And our goal is to understand where this pattern comes from. Now, how you describe this pattern, you may invent different names. You may focus on this object, call it a stick man. You may focus on this structure, call it a filament. You can use different words, but we, in science, we need to be qualitative, and ultimately we will be quantitative. So this is the best map of the universe for the distribution of galaxies that we had in 1999. Now, just to show you how fast the field is developing, in 1995, we had 10,000 galaxies. We had a map that went about a factor of 3 deeper. So here we are talking about 600 billion light years from us to where galaxies fade out. So you have the resolution to see that. And in the north and in the south, we have similar pictures. And that you, this was better. And here you also see that galaxies are not uniformly distributed, they're not randomly distributed. There are regions which are devoid of galaxies, voids. You have huge clusters of galaxies, you start filaments. So, from 1,000 galaxies in 1990, we went to 10,000 galaxies in 1995. And as of a year ago, we now have 100,000 galaxies. And if you want to plot 100,000 galaxies on one transparency, you basically just get black, too much data. So we only have too much data to represent on one transparency. So you have to cut out a certain amount of this data, and then you get plots that look at least visually nicer. So now then we go even further, a factor of 3 further in depth, but we still see these regions, the void of galaxies, these big clusters of galaxies. So this is the observed structure of the universe as we detect it using optical telescopes. Questions. Why are galaxies not randomly distributed? I would like to understand, can you see the back of the right here?
Yep.
Origin of the specific patterns. I would like to understand the answers to these questions. So, this was optical window to the universe. What we see using ordinary telescopes. Now, we have obviously if I write A, it's going to be at least G. Who knows? Another window to observe the structure of the universe with the same popularity.
Radio
telescopes, specifically light wind background. So the cosmic microwave. Now in 1965, Penzias and Wilson discovered by accident that from every direction in the sky, there's radiation, microwave radiation, impinging on the Earth. Penzias and Wilson were trying to build high sensitivity antennas, and they measured this as noise, which they didn't like. But that was actually the discovery of the cosmic microwave background. So, what you can do is you can just point your microwave telescope in any direction in the sky. You can measure the intensity of the microwave background, and the intensity you can express as a temperature. And you can compare intensities in different directions in the sky. And now you get a very interesting map, if you do this. So this is a projection of the sky onto a plane, like you make a map of the surface of the Earth. So this should be clear. And now I'm not hiding anything, but this is really the map. To very good accuracy, the temperature of the microfact in different directions in the sky is isotropic, the same in every direction. So, we would like to understand the origin of this CMB positive microwave background. We would like to understand the isotropy. So this was the R map of the microwave background, the best map we had until 1992. In 1992, there were two experiments which for the first time revealed that if you look back in great detail at the temperature map, it showed anisotropies. So this map shows the northern sky, the southern sky, and if you look at temperature differences, which are less than 0.01% of the background temperature. So the background temperature, the positive microwave background, is about 3 degrees above absolute zero. So even cold by central Canadian standards. Something for the Canadians. And these temperature differences between the hot spots and the cold spots are less than 0.1% of that temperature. So we are talking about 0.1 degree above absolute zero. So it's an experimental challenge to measure these anisotropies. Now these anisotropies were measured in 1992 by two different experiments. One experiment, which was a very expensive satellite experiment, the COBE satellite experiment, a multi-million US dollar NASA experiment with a substantial budget for publicity. And then there was a second experiment, which was a low-level, low-cost experiment coming out of the University of British Columbia in Canada by three people with zero publicity budget. They saw essentially the same map, and they got the absolute temperature better. So there are very small temperature differences in the microwave background. Is this random or is this not random? Who votes for random? Who votes for not random? Okay. Now you see, personally, although I would be prejudiced, if you are in the audience, I'd be prejudiced to believe that it's actually not random, since I'm standing here talking about this. I couldn't persuade you of this just by looking at this figure. So what does one do when one can't, by eye, see, convince oneself that this is not random or not? But what does one have to do? Compute. Quantify the data. You can't just say, look at this feature. Look at this feature. One has to do something, quantify the data. Basic scientific approach, which we are using in pathology, quantify the data. So let me illustrate what one does in the example of geography. We have a distribution of land on the Earth's surface, and this distribution of land is not random. So you invent a mathematical black box which turns the distribution of land into a plot which has one axis, length scale, and I choose my length scale such not length scale, but since we are dealing with a sphere, it's under scale. So large L means small under scale. Small L means large under scale. And this is the quantitative measure of deviation from randomness. And if the curve, so you have this mathematical black box, any mathematician can understand this perfectly well, what this black box is. If you feed the map into the black box and you get zero, in this curve A, it means that the distribution is random. If you get a curve which is different, then you have something that's not random. If you have a curve which is peaked here, it means that you have structure on large angular scales like continents. So for the Earth, if you're focusing on continents, then the curve would be peaked here. But if you look at islands in the ocean, you can have a map of islands in the ocean, you have a curve peaked here, because each island is very small. This map is called parsec. It's usually given a fancy name, so people think that we're doing something very fancy. Okay, so if anyone's interested, I can actually explain what kind of power spectrum is in detail. So you take this map, you feed it into the black box, and then you get a curve, which I'm not going to show you. I'll show it to you in a minute. First of all, remember that the first map that showed anisotropies was made in 1992. But in 1982, Alan Wolf, the physicist who based on his work at MIT, came up with a theory for the early universe, which he called the inflationary universe theory. And that theory predicted, as other people showed after him, that this distribution of the microwave background should be non-uniform, non-random. It should be non-random in this particular way. So there's a measure of angular scales where this total corresponds to 1 degree. This is about 1 arc minute. This would be 9 degrees. And Alan Wolf's theory predicted that. So 1981, no data, this prediction. So now I'll show you the data. So first of all, the map in 1992 was a map with very poor annual resolution. So therefore, it only gives us information about this spectrum for small values per large angle scale. So don't look at this test points here, because all that the 1992 map did is it gave us this plot, these points here. So this is angular scale, large angular scale, small angular scale, and this is the power. So in the between 1992 and 1999, there were quite a lot of other experiments done using balloons, measuring the microwave background of small angular scales, but only small portions of the sky. And they gave us this data, many data points, large error bars, but anisotropies measured. And then, in 1999, there was qualitative improvement, a much better satellite, First, the balloon called the boomerang. Balloon boomerang is come. Boomerang because the balloon was not on the outpost near the South Pole. It went round Antarctica and came back to its original launching site. Due to the long time that the balloon spent in the air, the observers were able to measure a fairly large portion of the sky. Here you see the debris of the sky. And this is the result of mapping. Hot spots, cold spots. You see a much better angle resolution. You feed this map into this mathematical black box. And out comes this curve. So you see these are the data points with the error bars. Every experiment has error bars. And the black curve is Alan Guth's curve. So you see 15 years, more than 15 years after Alan Guth invented his theory, the data has come together to show the agreement with the first picture. Now, about 1.5 years ago, there was a new satellite this time, WMAP satellite, which produced a full sky map of the microwave background with quite small angle resolution. Hot spots, cold spots. You feed this map of the entire sky into this black box. And out comes this top curve. This curve. So the red curve is Alan Guth's prediction, 1981. The black dots with the error bars I've cheated a little bit, and I'll come back to my cheat a little bit later. So since I'm cheating a little bit, I have to give you this transparency to keep it, because you have to force me to show it again later. The things that I absolutely need are to hear them. Okay. So now, questions which you would like to ask. Are you in the CLB? Why is it isotopic to very good accuracy? But origin of anisotropy. And origin of anisotropy is not just why are the anisotropies, but why are there the anisotropies of the specific kind that are observed? So what I want to impress you with is that the questions here that we ask in cosmology are the kind of questions we ask in every other branch of physics. We measure the nuclear curve, we like to explain the shape of that curve. It's like you do in a physics laboratory experiment. Just here, the data comes from constant. Okay, so we have different windows exploring the universe. Optical window, microwave window, there are other windows which have not been explored yet, which will be explored. And hopefully you will see that the field is making a lot of progress. I haven't said anything about theory. How do we understand all of this? Well, the first theoretical framework is the standard Big Bang model. And the standard Big Bang model is not that hard to explain. It rests on three pillars. And I'll start out with number two. Space is homogeneous and isotropic on large scales, which means space is easy to describe mathematically. So this principle was introduced because it allows a simple description. But the fact that the microwave background is so isotropic as I showed you. Hints that this isotropy has been confirmed observation to regularity. And the homogeneity in the distribution of galaxies is less firm, because initially, our initial view of the distribution of galaxies were absolutely inhomogeneous. But the larger the distance we look, the more the distribution converges to homogeneity. So that's one of the pillars of cosmology. The other pillar is something that you learned a lot in this 2 weeks, namely Einstein's realization that space-time is not absolute, space-time is dynamical, matter curves space-time. So this theory of general relativity is the pillar of standard Newtonian cosmology. Einstein's theory replaces Newton's theory of absolute space-time. So the third pillar is, well, if matter curves space-time, we have to know what the matter is in our universe. And the third pillar is that matter in standard Big Bang cosmology is just taken to be what we observe it to be now today. And today we observe galaxies. And galaxies are like blocks of matter. Stones, we can have very massive stones. You can call it dust. And the key feature of this dust is it carries energy, but there's no pressure. Because individual galaxies are so far apart, they're not bumping into each other. There's no pressure. So dust is some kind of matter with no pressure. And then the second ingredient of matter, which then is standard Big Bang cosmology, is the radiation. This is the microwave background radiation which is observed. This radiation has pressure. So these are the three ingredients. Please interrupt me if there are things that are obscure in what I'm saying. And so now, and especially those of you who are not from North America, it is practice in North America to ask questions of things. Not answer, but it's very important. So this comment about asking questions continuously. So now, Einstein's theory is very complicated. It's very complicated. But if you apply Einstein's theory to a space which is homogeneous and isotropic, the theory becomes very easy to deal with. This is why this is a key feature. And in particular, what this two features together, or these two pillars together in pi, is that space is expanding. And the way I want you to visualize this is by a race and bread analogy. So you have a dome, which represents space. You have radians, which represent the galaxies. You stick the dome in the oven. The dome expands. Therefore, the separation between the raisins increases. But every raisin thinks it's at rest in the dome. Every raisin thinks that the neighboring raisins are moving away from it. And every raisin thinks that the velocity at which other raisins are moving away from it is proportional to the distance from it. That should be completely obvious that the apparent velocity of a distant raisin is bigger than the apparent velocity of a close by raisin. So this is what follows if you merge Einstein's complicated theory with the assumption that space is homogeneous. And I want to give you another model to think about. And this model is a balloon. Let's imagine now that space is the surface of a balloon. and you blow up the balloon. And onto the surface of the balloon, you paint black points. White balloon, black points. Early time, late time. Solder. So, if you look at the distance between points at a later time, it will be bigger than the physical distance between the points at an earlier time. So if you write delta x as a distance, emphasize physical distance, which you measure with a measuring stick in our ordinary matter, then what you find is that delta x depends on time. This is time. And it will be increasing. It will be some number, which I call delta x sub c. It's just some number. And this is the distance between two galaxies. And this AFT has a fancy name. It's called the scale factor. But what does it represent in this balloon analogy? How should we visualize it?
Increase
narrative. But how can you visualize it? What's your metaphor? Radius. The radius of this balloon. So AFT is a radius of a balloon. Okay? So now, this AFT is important. What Einstein says is that if there's Mach in the universe, A will change. And that Einstein says that A will change into the wave. And I will have two equations, two key equations, which I'll write down right now, and I'll come back to them. This is the first equation. Now, who has not had profits? A little bit. So that we have to, you left us to look in the computer. But this A dot is the derivative of A with respect to time. So this whole quantity A dot over A, this is the expansion rate of the universe. The expansion rate of the universe is determined by the energy density. Rho is energy density. Energy per unit volume. So, if there is mass in the universe, if the energy density is not zero, the universe will either be expanding or contracting. It can't be static. Then, the second equation says that the time derivative of the energy density is equal to minus 3 times this h times the energy density plus the pressure. E is. So the change in the energy density depends not only on the fact that there is matter, but also on the type of matter that there is. So if the universe is dominated by radiation, you get different expansion than if the universe is dominated by matter.
What's the H in that?
This.
Oh, sorry.
The expansion rate of the universe. These are the two equations. So So now, for those of you who have calipers, I'll give you a problem, and this will have to be recorded. Exercise 1. You find that if the pressure is 0, then derive that A of T, derive that the energy density behaves as A of T to minus 3. Now this just means that the energy density is proportional, inversely proportional to the volume. That's easy to understand. You have a number of mass points. Each carries a certain amount of energy. You dilute them, the density goes down by the volume. That should be all that surprising. So that's exercise number 1. Exercise number 2 is if the pressure is 1/3 at the energy density, that's the case if you look at the radiation light with background, then you'll find that the energy density goes as A of T to the minus 4, which implies that if you multiply energy density by volume, you get something that goes as A to the minus 1, which means that energy is not conserved. Energy of matter is not conserved in the expanding universe. So whenever a high school teacher says energy is conserved, absolute principle of physics, absolute physics. You can ask me later when energy is conserved. Every instant, right now, math, the radiation is losing energy. That's what's okay. So these equations are all known. So what we do now is we I'll combine these equations. I'll leave them on the board. Put them in a box. And now I will use these equations to describe the history of the universe according to standard Euclidean cosmology. Time, but I want to plot different things here. So today, this is today, we have matter and we have radiation. And if you count up the number of galaxies and the mass of each galaxy and compare it with the energy in the microwave background, you find that the energy density in matter is much bigger than the energy density in microwave background. So now we take the results of my exercise. And the exercise that we will solve tomorrow. This tells you that if you go back in time, A of T is decreasing, the energy density in radiation is increasing faster than the energy density in matter. So this is how the energy densities will evolve. The energy density in matter, subscript chems, that's the matter. Energy density in radiation is subscript fast, that's the radiation. So therefore you conclude that there was a time in the old universe before which the universe was dominated by radiation, after which the universe was dominated by matter. This is called the time of equal matter radiation. T sub EQ. Not a fancy name at all. So therefore I don't need to. You can just call it TDQ. It's a cross. What I'm talking is energy density. Okay. Now, let's take the radiation, which is described by the temperature today, degrees Kelvin. We go backwards in time. The universe is decreasing in size. What's happening to the radiation? served people as an increase, most increasing, densely increasing, so therefore, to describe the radiation as temperature. Temperature is increasing. So as October, the past temperature is increasing. Now, that means that the different particles gain, so temperature means that particles have a lot of energy, they lock together with a lot of energy. So there's a temperature above which atoms have so much energy that they knock off the electrons. So that instead of having atoms, you have nuclei and electrons separate your plasma. So there was a since the temperature is increasing as you go back, you know that there will be a time before which the universe was not made up of neutral atoms, but made up of positively charged nuclei and negatively charged electrons, all the way into space and got lost. And it turns out, and if we need that calculation to show that, that this temperature, which divides the neutral universe from the plasma universe, the plasma universe means that the nuclei and the electrons are not bound, they are whisked independently from space, but that occurred at the temperature called the temperature of recombination. Time of recombination is after 3.1. It corresponds to a universe with about 100 so now standard Big Bang cosmology predicts that the early universe was a plasma. If we take this plasma and you go forward in time, we find that at this time, electrons and nuclei combine to form hydrogen. What happens if, who knows what happens when electrons and nuclei combine to form hydrogen? Energy is released. And energy is released as what? As light, as electromagnetic radiation. This electromagnetic radiation loses energy. So if you take as the universe expands, and it's that radiation which is reached us today as positive microwave background. So the standard Big Bang cosmology makes a prediction. It predicts that there should be a positive microwave background. Now the standard Big Bang model of cosmology was developed in the 1940s, 1950s. And it was Big Bang theory, it's called Big Bang theory, it was considered a pejorative term. And the famous Soviet physicist, Zalovich, he said, this Big Bang model cannot possibly be true, because if it were true, by the object that I just gave you, the object would be a microwave background, and he made these statements in the 50s, before the microwave background was discovered, and then he said, there is no microwave background, yet the Big Bang is wrong. So therefore, the fact that there is a microwave background is a prediction of standard Big Bang cosmology, and that's what we want. We want a theory which doesn't only explain what we already know, but it makes predictions. If you just invent a new theory which predicts everything that we already know, which is in agreement with everything that we already know, and it predicts nothing new, it's a useless theory. Any new theory that you will go on to discover ought to make a new prediction. And the standard Big Bang theory made a prediction, namely the existence of a cosmic microwave background. Now, it didn't only predict that there was a cosmic microwave background, but it also predicted that this background had a very special distribution, namely a black body distribution. So if you measure the microwave background at a particular time, then not every particle will have the same energy, but the energies will be distributed about the mean energy. when the sum distribution can be derived theoretically. So now I've landed into the red box for the sum. So this plot is energy expressed in terms of wave number. This is number of particles or fraction of particles with that energy. This is the black body. Who's ever seen such a curve, black body curve? Who's heard of black body? And this is black body. This is not the black body curve, which I'm showing you. This is the observed. Observed by the Toby satellite and this team out in Vancouver. So what would every physicist ask when seeing a plot like this and me claiming that this is the observed curve? What every good physicist ask?
What the theoretical? What the theoretical?
No. An experimental physicist will not ask what is the theoretical curve first, but seeing data, error bars. Now, the error bars of this curve are smaller than the thickness. And this is a black body curve. In fact, this is so good a black body that at the time of the experiment, there was no black body in the lab, which was a black body for better practice. So, now you could say a prediction of standard Big Bang cosmology, spectacular success, we should go home and celebrate. That's not what we should do, given what you know one has achieved something, one has learned something, but what does one not understand? Well, standard Big Bang cosmology explains the fact that there is a classified very background, but it does not explain its isotropy. So, and remember that to a very good accuracy, the cosmic microwave background is isotropic. Remember this curve? The first thing we knew about the cosmic microwave background, the isotropy, standard declining, explains why point by point in the sky there is a microwave background, but it's not explained yet. And the reason is, I'll try to explain the reason in this diagram. So this diagram, this axis represents space, this axis represents time. This is the point in time at which, according to standard Big Bang cosmology, the temperature was infinite. This is a Big Bang. This is the temperature of gas scattering when the plasma, when the electrons combine with the nuclei, the molecule. This is today. You can calculate how far information could have traveled from the Big Bang in different directions in the sky. It's indicated by these two lines. And you can compare this distance. This is the distance which could have been partially affected by something. You can compare to the distance over which the microwave background is observed to be isotropic. So we look at the microwave background in the opposite direction in the sky. This is the microwave background from one direction of the sky, opposite direction of the sky. Same temperature here and here. And the calculation, which I will not ask you to do as an exercise, that would be important for undergrad students, would be to verify that I'm not cheating when I'm part of the graph this way. So with the standard Big Bang cosmology, the region over which the microwave fat has the same temperature is much, much larger than the distance which could have been possible. So therefore, standard Big Bang cosmology cannot explain why the temperature here and here is the same. So I want you to keep this transparency. Now remember, we want to explain the origin of game homogeneities and other particles in the universe. Standard Big Bang cosmology cannot explain the origin of fluctuations. Another space-time diagram, time, space. This is the distance that light could have traveled from the Big Bang. Distance of light could have traveled from the Big Bang, if it's flickering time. We observe structures on a very large scale today. And at times when galaxy formation started, the length scale that corresponds to structures which we observe today was larger than the distance of light could travel. So there's no way to produce structure on this scale in any way that the base laws that we'll learn about in these 2 weeks. That's pretty bad, because that's what we observe. We observe inhomogeneities and anisotropies, and in standard Big Bang cosmology there's no origin. No way to explain the origin. Impossible. And now I'm going to give the next credit for the Hubble plot for you. Think about the loopholes in biology. They actually loopholes in biology. Now, another problem of the standard Big Bang cosmology is possible. If you trace equations of standard Big Bang cosmology back in the past, you find that 10 billion years before now, the temperature was infinite. The energy density was infinite. So standard Big Bang cosmology predicts an initial point in space-time where every quantity was infinite. Curvature was infinite, energy density was infinite, temperature was infinite, pressure was infinite. Now, this is absolutely incompatible with what we know. We reduce, but in order to derive this prediction, we use the physics which is applicable in all world of today at low densities. We know from experiments and accelerators that the physics of high densities is very different than the physics at low densities. So in deriving the prediction that there was a Big Bang in the past, what we've done is we've taken our theory, which might be valid today, but we've extrapolated it way beyond the limit of its validity. So, Big Bang theory predicts artificial singularity. We could also say Big Bang theory is no longer valid. That's what we've done at times. And we have no right to claim that we know anything about this theory. So, we obviously need a better theoretical framework. And this is where Alan Kruth came. So the second theoretical framework, which is a slight improvement on the initial one, is called the inflationary universe. Now, who has heard of this inflationary universe? So what I explained before is that in standard Big Bang cosmology, the universe was supposed to have started in the sixth hierarchy, after which the universe was plasma, then the universe became neutral, and we ended up here today. The universe was expanding throughout. The universe started out with this singularity. Now, in inflationary cosmology, we make a small modification of this timeline. We assume that there was a period in the very early universe when the universe was expanding exponentially in size. Period of exponential expansion of space. Which means that this A of t, which describes size of space, is supposed to be exponential. Exponential growth in the period. That's what it means. So this basic idea, and let me have one of my conferences. That's the one. Now this very simple idea leads to a solution to this problem. So what has happened is that now we oscillate, if there was a current curve, well, the universe expanded exponentially. This means that you have the right idea, but the physical distance of light can travel increases exponentially in this time interval. And this is the overlay here. There's this period of inflation. And so this curve, which indicates the distance of light can travel, is exponentially larger than what we believe in standard wavelength time. So now it's perfectly possible to understand the origin of same temperature here, because these points started out like those together. What happens to the origin structure? Slightly longer. During this time, the physical length corresponding to the separation of two rays is increasing exponentially. And so, therefore, at early times, the separation of two rays is extremely small. In fact, it turns out that the separation of rays is smaller than the typical length scale that describes the expansion of the universe. There's a length scale that corresponds to the time that light travels when the universe doubles in size. And this length scale is the inverse length. It is constant. So, inflation can explain the origin of structure potentially, and it can resolve the problems of the first term of the In fact, inflation makes a prediction. So what we want to do is we want to look at structures today on different length scales. For example, small angular scales and large angular scales. And we want to compare the magnitude of the anisotropies on these different length scales. Because we measure them. Now what inflation predicts is that both scales started out on very small microscopic distances early on. Inflation postulates that the energy density was constant during this period of inflation. Physics was the same at all times. So let's imagine that you have a demon sitting in this hot early soup of the universe, and this demon is stirring the soup with a ladle producing waves. Since the soup has the same temperature at all times, the demon will be stirring the soup with the same force at all times, and at all times this demon will be producing waves. This red wave will be produced at an earlier time than the green wave, but with the same amplitude. Therefore, the red wave will arrive today with the same amplitude as the green wave. So, inflation predicts a very special relationship between the amplitude of the density waves on different length scales. And the relationship has a fancy name. It's called a scale invariant comparison, I don't know. The key thing is that inflation makes a prediction.
But I got here.
Really?
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So now, I will need back the first one. Where is this coming from? So, what I've argued is that inflation produces density waves. This even strongly hot oil superinflation in the universe produces density waves. These density waves will produce positive microwave background as well. And the inflation scenario produces density waves with a fixed ratio on different scales, and therefore the microwave anisotropies on different angle scales will be related. I don't expect you to be able to derive this ratio, but the main thing is that you should understand that there is a definite prediction that exists here. And I'll illustrate this prediction. Sorry, I'll illustrate the way in which density waves produce skin anisotropies. So we have time, we have space. Let's look at the surface in space-time, which has the same constant temperature. Temperature of recombination. Density waves means that different densities mean different temperatures. So if you have a density wave, it means that the same temperature will occur at different times at different points in space. So this surface is T equals constant. T being temperature. So now we are looking at the microwave background radiation coming to us from different directions in the sky. The microwave background has left this point in space-time with the same temperature as this one. This one has traveled longer to reach us than this one. It has lost more energy than this one. So therefore, this photon will arrive to us at a higher temperature. Density waves produce microwave background radiation.
What causes the density waves?
So the way that I explained this, it's a demon stirring the hot soup. The name of the demon is quantum vacuum.
Say it again, what?
Quantum vacuum fluctuation.
Vacuum?
You have a vacuum, and in this vacuum you have small quantum mechanical oscillation. And that's the point I did not want to miss. So anyway, from this picture and from our understanding of the demon producing density waves, you produce this red curve. But I'm still not telling you the full truth, so I have to keep that. How to obtain inflation? So, I'm going back to these equations. What we want is we want H, the expansion rate, to be constant. Because if this was in unit inflation, if A is this, then A dot of A is constant. So we want this to be constant. We only get this to be constant if this is constant. By the way, G is equal to constant. So rho is constant means rho dot is zero. Rho dot is zero means H has to be minus energy density. So inflation requires P equals minus rho, negative pressure. who knows of matter with a negative pressure? Who's ever heard of that? So now, there is a fancy word which people in pop physics use. Whenever they want something which looks very strange to achieve, they will be able to use it. They will say, there exists a scalar field. Scalar matter. Now you'll probably learn in these 2 weeks that particles are described by fields, when you understand. People call things scalar matter. Scalar fields are easy to describe. The problem with scalar fields is that no one has ever observed a particle which corresponds to a scalar field. No one has ever observed a particle. However, I can give you a toy model for the scalar field. And the toy model for the scalar field will form a Python table. And at each point, the table corresponds to space. At each point on the table, you have a pencil. A pencil, which is pinned down. I'm doing this now as a huge gravitational field of the Earth. So each table, each pencil will want to lie flat on the table. If I call this angle phi, then the phi will want to be pi. I'll connect the top of the pencils by strings. Then what I have is at each point. Point on the table. I have a pencil with an angle 5x. This is the angle of the pencil. This is an example of the scale. And this scalar field has potential energy. And this potential energy can be reinflated. Because this potential energy has negative. I wrote down the expression for the empty density. There's energy of motion, spring energy, potential energy, it's gravitational potential energy. I drew the form of the gravitational potential energy here. This is the angle of the angle wants to be pi over 2 or minus pi over 2. The associated pressure is given by this one. That back comes to the angle. Here. So it's possibly fixed. Now, big success of inflation and cosmology. So what should we do? So we go, this was a year and a half back. That's good scientists. What should we do? Should we go home and celebrate? Or should we do something else? Go and celebrate. No, we should actually look for the problems. inflation does no better at eliminating the Big Bang than standard Big Bang solving. Because before the period of inflation, there was a supernova. So in the same way that we cannot trust standard Big Bang cosmology at early times, we cannot trust inflation cosmology at early times. We still don't know what the early universe was. We still don't know whether there was a Big Bang or whether the universe was expanding from it. Another problem, probably I've gone too fast here, so let's take a look. Yes. Now, in inflationary cosmology, scales, they are cosmological. At the beginning of inflation, they were tiny. In fact, they were too small. You can calculate that in all models of inflation, these scales were smaller than the smallest length scale that we know in physics, namely the length scale associated with Newton's constant. We know that we don't know the physics of these length scales. However, in inflation cosmology, we track the waves which Feynman produces from the beginning of inflation to using the wrong theory. But we don't know whether if we have a correct theory of physics on small scales, whether the predictions will change completely or not, or whether they don't. Finally, I was going to almost finish. So now I'm probably going over the head of most of you. There is something called cosmological constant problem, which I urge you to think about. Because for the past at least 50 years, it's been the outstanding problem in fundamental physics. And the fact that according to our quantum mechanical understanding of matter, there should be a huge vacuum energy permeating all of space. And this vacuum energy is not observed. The vacuum energy which is predicted is 120 orders of magnitude larger than the maximum contribution it could have. So the biggest discrepancy in physics ever between theory and experiment. Now, what this potential energy of this pencil model does, it acts exactly the same way as this quantum vacuum energy. And since we know that we don't understand quantum vacuum energy, we have no right to think that we understand potential energy in this pencil model. So it's a key unsolved problem in fundamental physics, which lies at the heart of inflation. So we don't understand the conceptual foundations of inflation at the moment. So in spite of the spectacular success between data and theory, we cannot go with the subject. But what we should do is we need to develop a new theory of the very universe. So now finally I have come to what I missed, what I didn't mention. And I thought this agreement between theory and experiment, theory and observation. Alan Guth's theory has a few three grounds. So numbers which can set in the theory, which will affect the prediction. Maybe six or seven numbers. So there are thousands of data points, but you have to fix seven numbers. And one number you have to fix is the energy density in the universe. And one. the total energy density. This is determined from the possibilities by these micro particles. Let me call this one. I will use units in which total energy density is 1. Now, in these units, I can tell you the energy density in stars. And you find much less than 1. You look at the energy density in galaxies, and in the large scale structure that we observed, which I showed you before, and you get less than 40%. Actually, you get approximately 40%. With a little bit of theory, you can calculate the energy density in the stuff that we are made out of. Stuff we know in the lab. Matter we know. There we are. We find the possible terms. So you get good agreement between inflation theory and observations if the total amount of matter that we see in galaxies is about this 20%. Which is 3 times more than the maximum amount of stuff in matter that we are made out of, which in itself is much, much more than stars. So the difference between the matter in galaxies and the stuff that we are made out of that's called the energy in dark matter. There needs to be dark matter who's not out of dark matter. Okay. So dark matter is matter which has no pressure. So it's like ordinary matter. It interacts with gravity like ordinary matter. But it is not made of any kind of particles that we have observed in the lab. So we don't know what the dark matter is, but we know that it interacts with gravity in a unique way. There's more dark matter than regular matter. But now, you see there's a difference between rho total minus rho galaxies. And this is something that we've never measured. We don't know what it is. We know that it does not interact with gravity like ordinary matter. It's even weirder than ordinary matter. It's called, who knows what it's called? Dark energy. So we know nothing about dark matter except that it interacts with gravity like ordinary matter. We know less than nothing about dark energy. Because we don't even know that it interacts foundation like this. We know that it's not. I'm using words of the famous term now, as well as Scott's code. So you see that the stuff we are made up of is less than 10% of the total. 70% of the total is completely weird. 30% of the stuff is a little bit weird. 20% is a little bit weird, and only 10% is neutral. That's the universe which we see. So this is the ultimate Copernican revolution, not only in the Earth of the center of the universe, not only in the solar system of the center of the universe, not only in the gap in our galaxy, not the center of the universe, but the stuff that we are made up of is not the stuff of the universe. So, there's a lot to learn. And I think I've probably exhausted the patience of a lot of you. So we need a new technology. although we've learned a lot, the more we have learned, the more questions we've uncovered. We've answered a lot of questions, but the more questions we answer, the more interesting questions we've uncovered. There is an attempt to develop a new cosmology based on superstring theory, and you'll hear about superstring theory. Who's heard about superstring theory? How many dimensions of space are there for space? How many do we observe? Slight problem here. Not a problem, but a challenge. The dimensionality of space is a new question that we would like to understand the answer to. I do not have time to present you with the answer, but there's a good chance that with string theory we understand the answer to that. We have a scenario with string theory that predicts that only three-dimensional space can be known. But the basic theme is, the more we probe, the more we answer, the more interesting questions emerge. It's a field which is developing very, very rapidly. It's driven by observations, theories way behind. It's a fun field. There are lots of observations, lots of data, lots of speculation, lots of philosophy. It's going to be alive in many, many years, and that's relevant for observations. Thanks.
The matter with negative pressures, I think as you go over the how the toy model explains that.
Like, how the toy model explains negative pressure. And that's not that easy to do. But you see, the crucial thing is that the springs will make the pencils move in direction of increasing potential energy.